and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Thursday edition. As you Americans know, it is a Thanksgiving. It is the holiday that I most enjoy in America, and I hope you're all enjoying yours. We've got a wonderful guest today on this November 23rd, 2006. His name is James Dickey. We're going to talk a little bit about false flag operations and how balkanization has been a game plan throughout the last, well, I dare say governments have always used groups pitting one against the other to meet their ends. But false flag operations that stretch back for 120 years or so into Turkey, into Iran at its founding, Iraq in its founding, and Lebanon, many, many different parts of this world have been partitioned using disparate groups to foment problems that later could be exploited for control. It happens in the United States between African Americans and whites and Latinos and whites. It happens in Britain between Pakistanis and British, as well Caucasian British, as well as in France with the Algerians. This is an old tactic that has been tried and true for the controllers, ladies and gentlemen. But how it has shown itself in the political realm is what we're going to bring our guest on to talk about tonight. Today, his name is James Dickey. He's a professor. He's a researcher. He's an interesting man, a writer, an author. He's been doing research on these subjects for many decades, and deserves everybody's attention when he speaks about these issues. So I'll bring him right up right now. James, are you with me?
Yes, with you all the way.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier, and I want to go right back into it. Some of the partitioning of this region has its roots in the 1880s and 90s, and maybe even a little earlier than that, when the caliph was actually seeking out financial support in the Jewish banking community. He brought himself some people to help him that turned out to be not quite as good a friend as he thought they were. Am I correct in that?
You're 101% correct. In fact, it was the introduction of Western banking into the Ottoman Empire, which ruined Ottoman industry in the 19th century and put it under foreign control. It was at the same period as the capitulations, you know, whereby foreigners were immune from prosecution under Turkish or Ottoman law, and so they could more or less do what they wanted, financially as well as any other way.
Well, there's a name for this group when they came in. They were called the Young Turks, were they not?
The name Young Turk came later. Really, the Young Turks were a product of a process that began back in 1828, known as the Tanzimat. Now, Tanzimat means reorganization. That is to say, the reorganization of the Ottoman Empire along European lines.
Mm-hmm.
And it begins with the accession of the reforming sultan, Mahmud II, in 1828, and continues right down till the end of the First World War. That whole phase of Turkish history is known as the Tanzimat.
And now that period of time, there was a decade-by-decade dismantling of the Arab, well, Persian control. And these people are a mixed race. They're Turkishmen, aren't they? They're a mixed race within Turkey. Persian and some steps of Russia inside their blood mix. What kind of ethnic mix is Turkey today and at that time even?
Speaking of two different things, speaking of the Ottoman Empire,
right,
and the Turkish Republic. The
yes.
Turkish Republic professes to be ethnically pure, but of course it's not, because there's a substantial Kurdish minority which is persecuted, and which the Turkish ruling establishment has driven into the arms of the left and indeed of Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ottoman Empire was a multi-ethnic empire. You have to understand that in Islam, traditionally, allegiances have never been national. Nationalism is something that entered the Middle East after the Napoleonic invasion of Egypt. Allegiance, historically in Islam, allegiances have always been religious and dynastic. That is to say, if you were a Sunni Muslim, your allegiance was to the Caliphate, which is a Sunni institution,
yeah,
and which meant that your allegiance was to Istanbul, the seat of the Caliphate. If you were, however, a Shiite Muslim and did not recognize the existence of a caliphate, really your allegiance was to Safavid Iran. And these two mighty empires were in conflict with each other for centuries. And, you know, in assessing the present state of Iran, we have to realize that the ulama, the mullahs, the clerical class there, are the products of Safavid Shiism. And Safavid Shiism is essentially a political creed. Its purpose was to separate and isolate Iran from the rest of the Muslim world, because down to 1501, the accession of Shah Ismail the Safavid, Iran was a Sunni country. And he brought in da'is, that is to say missionaries, from the Atabad, that is to say the great Shiite educational centers in Iraq, like Najaf and Karbala, and the people were converted, in fact, by force. Now, the whole object of this was to prevent Iran being swallowed up either by the Ottoman Empire to the west or by the Mughal Empire to the east. And indeed, he triumphantly succeeded in that. But a price has to be paid for this, and the price that is paid is Iran's physical and cultural and political and religious isolation from the rest of the Muslim world. This now, isolation is, however, breaking down now.
Now, to the north of this area, in the trade routes that went all the way up to Scandinavia,
you
were your Khazarians,
the
Khazars.
Yes. Yes.
Now, the Khazars had an empire of their own, and they happened to accede to Judaism in the 7th and 8th centuries. Now, what was the effect of this triple group? You had three competing groups around this one region. How did these Khazarians work themselves into this?
There are two books on the subject. One of them is The Conversion of the Jewish Khazars, and of course the other is the famous book by Arthur Koestler, the 11th tribe.
The 13th tribe.
13th tribe, I'm sorry, I stand corrected.
Yeah, when we look at this, the Jews have always claimed Babylon as one of their centers of Talmudic and Kabbalistic and Zoharian study, and that was also in the hands of a different group at the time they were there. They were forced out of that region, were they not?
No, because when Cyrus allowed the Jews to return to Palestine from the Babylonian exile, only a few of them chose to go. The majority remained in Mesopotamia, where they were doing very well, thank you.
So, basically, we have these groups, and the ultimate winner in this battle for a supremacy in that region several few hundred years ago were the Ottomans. Where did their borders extend to?
Roughly the eastern border of modern-day Iraq, which is an artificial state and a product of the of Versailles.
And did it go all the way into the northern parts of Egypt?
The Ottoman Empire.
Yes.
It went right up to the to the Atlantic.
So
it included Sicily, Tunisia, Algeria, and somewhat tenuously Morocco.
So
it was a mighty empire. The Ottoman Empire, Darrell, we have to understand, was larger and longer lived than the Roman Empire. It lasted for 600 years. It's one of the greatest political achievements of history. And this is a testimony to the political genius of the Ottoman race. Now, maybe the Turanian races, now maybe these people, the Turanian races, they do not have the same intellectual brilliance as the Arabs or the Persians. In other words, they haven't got this great literary and scientific achievement. But their achievement in other fields has been just as significant. Their achievement is primarily in the fields of social, political, and military organization.
Ah. Now, where were their conflicts with Christendom, and when was it decided that they would be infiltrated by powerful banking forces? And how was that decision made as far as history treats it?
Well, at one point, the Ottoman Empire came as far up as Belgrade. And that was recovered, I think, by the Austrians in about 1712. And we now think of Belgrade as an exclusively Serbian city. But at one time, it was a Muslim city with mosques, baths, madrasas, bazaars. And if you look at Sarajevo today, the old part is essentially Muslim, with bazaars, mosques, madrasas, and beautiful Turkish houses.
Mm.
However, the Ottoman Empire was on retreat from that moment on. I think I gave you the wrong date. I think it's 1729, the fall of Belgrade.
Mm-hmm.
And as conditions got worse over 100 years, this brought about the Tanzimat, because the Ottoman elite saw that this as a cause of their backwardness, their isolation from Europe. And in order to catch on, they would have to copy European institutions. And even though Sultan Abdulhamid tried to isolate the Ottoman Empire from all extraneous, un-Islamic, un-Ottoman influences, there was one institution he had to leave alone, and that was the army. And this is very significant in the history of Turkey, because it meant that the army became the vehicle of westernization, and that it has remained down to the present day. Now, perhaps there is nothing bad in that, since the Ottomans, by their own admission, were technologically backward, and the West had the technology. However, westernization came to mean ultimately Americanization, because just after NATO was founded, Turkey applied for membership of NATO and became the sheet anchor of NATO. And the American influence is everywhere present in Turkey. You just need to go to Atatürk's mausoleum and look at the fancy drill which the guard perform there. And it's all American style. And you can see that these people have been to West Point, whereas formerly, down to 1939, they would have been at Potsdam.
Right. Well, now, at the same time, this great empire, coming under pressure, it had financial problems, not dissimilar to the American empire that is now being dismantled as we speak, and they've come under terrible pressure, and they've had to go out into the world and borrow money to keep their continued empire afloat. And so the Ottomans came under terrible financial strain, and they allowed certain elements of the financial elites of Europe, and that means Jewish bankers, to come in and start providing them with financing to keep their empire fluid, as it were. Am I right?
Yes, and in the cabinet, since Islam is a very tolerant religion, there were many non-Muslim ministers, Armenians and Jews. So it was not just a multi-ethnic, it was a multicultural, multi-religious empire. In fact, emblematic, an icon of religious tolerance. However, because the Ottoman Jews had their relations in Europe, in commerce and banking, certainly links were set up. And the so-called Ottoman Bank, whose offices you can see everywhere in Turkey, is really British. There's nothing Ottoman about it.
Mm. Now, once they became beholden to this banking group, they found themselves starting to acquiesce to more influence from this group into the government structures. And then you find the new Turks starting to exert some influence. Am I correct in that?
Now, the new Turks are Masonic. So let me read you a passage from Professor Nielis's introduction to his edition of the Protocols, published in Moscow in 1905. It's that very interesting but very sinister passage in which he talks about the symbolic stake. Hmm? Protocol 3 opens with a reference to the symbolic snake of Judaism. In his epilogue to the 1905 edition of the Protocols, Nielis gives the following interesting account of this symbol. Now, I can't read the whole thing because it's quite long, mm-hmm. but it ends up, "It is now well known to us to what extent the latter cities," he's referring to Moscow, Kiev, and Odessa, "form the centers of the militant Jewish race." And this is writing in 1905, remember, before the revolution.
Yep.
"Constantinople is shown as the last stage of the snake's course." Now, he's talking about a map on which the head of the snake is the Jewish elite, that is to say, the Zionist elite. "The body of the snake is the ordinary body of Jewish believers who are being led or misled by this head. Now, on the map, it is shown the different cities along their progress. And as it said laterally, the further course of the snake is not shown on this map, but arrows indicate its next movement toward Moscow, Kiev, and Odessa. It is now well known to us to what extent the latter cities form the centers of the militant Jewish race. Constantinople is shown as the last stage of the snake's course before it reaches Jerusalem. This map was drawn years before the occurrence of the Young Turk, i.e. Jewish Revolution in Turkey. I'm not making any of this up. I'm quoting from Professor Nilus.
Well, now, as we know, they were successful in beginning the dismantling process, but then comes into play at this time Western powers. You start seeing agreements between the German elite and the British elite in Turkey, and so this is just in advance of the First World War. Could you give us a little snapshot of that? Because
let me give you a synopsis of the events leading up to this titanic conflict. We can date the origins of the First World War back to the First Zionist Congress in Bâle in 1897.
That's right.
Now, of course, those Jewish or Zionist bankers knew well that the Ottoman Empire was bankrupt, and they thought that they could buy Palestine from Sultan Abdul Hamid. Obviously, they did not realize that they were dealing with a man of principle. He sent them away with a flea in their ear. He said, the Palestinians have fought with us in the Morea in naming three or four theaters of warfare. We will not abandon them now. He's using the royal plural. We will not abandon them now. They may cut us up after we are dead, but vivisection we will not tolerate. Now, that was prophetic, because after 1918, or to be more precise, in 1920, the Ottoman Empire was cut up into segments, one of which is the modern Iraq, which is now in its own turn falling apart, the process of Balkanization that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Now, let me go on a bit. Let me take a jump in time from 1897 and the failure of the Herzl delegation in Istanbul to what is known as the March the 31st incident. This is one of the most famous incidents in the whole of Turkish history. It is the point at which not just Turkish, but Middle Eastern history went wrong. And in fact, it's never gone right since. It is the first instance in the history of Islam of the coup d'etat, that is to say, of the military taking power. Now, when an army takes power in the East, it does not do so to enforce a particular direction of policy desired by the majority of the people. Rather, the army is a thing acting at the behest of invisible powers. In this case, the bankers or the Freemasons, because, as I said, when Sultan Abdul Hamid attempted to isolate the Ottoman Empire from Western influence, the one institution he had to leave alone because of its technological backwardness was the Turkish army. Now, when the, I think it was the 3rd Army Corps of Salonika, marched on Istanbul on March the 31st to impose the constitution on the Sultan, that they were linked to a group, a Masonic group in Istanbul, in the politics of Istanbul, known as the Party of Freedom and Progress, who were, of course, expressions of the Tanzimat. This was not in itself sufficient. Later, Sultan Abdul Hamid was deposed and sent into exile. You remember the famous incident when he asked if he could take his beloved cat with him into exile. At any rate, there are several things that took place just around that time of 1908. One was the Tangier incident in 1906. If you've read Mein Kampf, you must know that Hitler, who was very critical of the Kaiser, one reason he said that he disliked him so much was because he missed the chance for war in 1906. And the Tangier incident was when the Kaiser, visiting Tangier, and Tangier at that time was part of the Sharifian Empire, now known as Morocco, and an independent state, which, however, the French were planning to invade and take over and incorporate into their North African Francophone Empire, like Algeria and Tunisia. The Kaiser made a statement in support of Moroccan independence, which infuriated the French government. The war was narrowly averted in 1906. French troops were moved up to the Franco-German frontier, and Germany mobilized her reserves. Now, war, in fact, did not take place, but the Triple Entente was founded in 1907, following year, after the Algiers crisis of the previous year. Then there was the Agadir incident, and the Great Game, that is to say the rivalry between the British Empire and the Tsarist Empire as to who should control the whole of Asia, was formally brought to an end by the Algeciras Conference in Spain on August the 31st, 1907. That marks the end of the Great Game, which had been going on ever since the end of the Napoleonic Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is there was a whole realignment. Britain, the hereditary enemy of France, had become, through the Entente Cordiale, the ally of France, and then Russia was brought in as the third member of the Triple Entente. This meant the encirclement of Germany by hostile powers on every side. Britain, with its great naval power, the largest navy in the world, France, with its considerable military power perched on Germany's western frontier, and Russia, with her inexhaustible manpower reserves, perched again on what is now the Polish frontier. So this sets the stage for a world war. And what brought Turkey into it was the arrival of the Goiban and the Breslau in August 1914, a few days after war had started in Europe. And Turkey then throws in a lot with Germany, because with those two warships, she is able to bombard Sevastopol. So that sets the scene for the First World War, and the defeat of Turkey means the partition of the Ottoman Empire. It means also that Britain hands over Palestine to the Zionists, and hence the roots of the present crisis lie in that phase of history.
Now, we also saw them doing partitioning on some very bizarre... In other words, they were breaking up nations based on longitude, latitude, not on dialects or language.
I mean, the boundaries in the Middle East, they correspond to no historical, geographic, demographic, or historical, or even religious reality. For instance, two states, Iraq and Jordan, are the creations of an arch Zionist, namely Sir Winston Churchill. Jordan was created as a compensation prize. The whole thing was how to satisfy the ambitions of these ambitious desert princelings, the sons of the Sharif Hussein. Now, they didn't want the Sharif to get too big for his boots, because when he wanted the caliphate for himself, then they exiled him to Malta, where he died, and you can go and visit his grave in the Muslim cemetery there in Valletta. I've done so myself. Now, his sons then were all given kingdoms. The French, with the connivance of their wartime allies, the British, they drove Faisal out of Syria, and the British then created Iraq for him as a consolation prize. So Iraq is an artificial state, and the same with Abdullah, another of the Sharif Hussein's sons. It was created by Churchill in the Foreign Office with a ruler on a map of the Middle East. So again, this is part of that process of compensation, the creation of artificial states, the installation of rulers who are clients of the people who install them, and run the states in the interests of their masters.
Well, now, what we we do know, James, is that in each of these instances, they always allowed a substantial minority to rest within the borders of these delineated countries, mm-hmm. so that they could foment or foster derision between these groups, because that was the best way to have. I mean, if you've got someone to hate, then you can control.
Definitely.
And it seems like they did this in every instance. They, in Lebanon, for example, of course, they left certain communities of Muslims very deeply intermixed with Christians. And what you found there was that you did not have a homogeneity. What you had was a disparate group that could be brought against the other whenever you needed.
Oh, Lebanon is the perfect example. Down to 1925, if you had said to MD in Damascus, I'm going to Lebanon, they would have thought you were going to a mountain. There was no country called Lebanon. Lubnan is the name of a mountain. It is, interestingly enough, the same word as Leban, milk, because the root is an Arabic root, meaning white. In other words, it's a reference to the snow on the mountaintops. Lebanon was created by the French in 1925 as a base for their interests in the area, using the Christian minority living in the coastal areas of Syria, chiefly in the mountain.
Now, we've got I'm reading right now the death of this man, Gamiel, Pierre Gamiel. His father was, of course, a Falange leader,
yeah.
Very, very well aligned with the criminality of Israel's 1982 invasion and the Christian Falange murder of the Shabila and Sabra camps by the Falange. In other words, there have been these relationships go back not just to 1982, but all the way to the beginning of the last century.
Well, you take their names. I mean, Pierre, what is Arabic about that?
There you go.
The Arabic for Peter is Boutros. Jumayel, also you can hardly recognize behind it the Arabic original, which is Jumayel, meaning the little beautiful one. But far from beautiful, I think, in view of the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, which we know were carried out by the Falange, as you correctly say, Kata'ib in Arabic, by the Falange, with the connivance of Israel, in fact, with the active support of the Israeli army, because they provided the weapons for the phalanx to go into the two Palestinian camps of Sabra and Shatila. They set up the searchlights and the floodlights on the perimeter of the camps so as to illuminate the scene and allow them to carry out their massacre. So you are right. I mean, they are criminals, but let's remember that Lebanon is ruled by Christian warlords. It's just like what China was in the 1920s and the 1930s.
Well, so now we've got this Balkanizing effect, and they used it quite well to their advantage in the partitioning of Tito's little empire over in Serbia and Kosovo and
mm-hmm.
now.
Well, I view it from a different perspective. You see, it was a toss-up between a Greater Serbia and a Serbian Empire. So Tito, although he was a Croat, the capital of Yugoslavia was the capital of Serbia. The army was totally dominated by Serbs, the police force by Serbs, everything except the economy, which the economy and the intelligentsia were dominated by the Croats and the Bosnians. Following the logic that we have said before, that the lesson of history is that artificial states sooner or later break up into their component residual parts. This has happened in Czechoslovakia, showing retrospectively, although no one will admit it, that Hitler was right, that Czechoslovakia was not a proper state. It has happened in Yugoslavia, and now it's happening in the Middle East.
Well, and do you think it's by design, or I mean, because it seems to me what they do when they're working, they're very patient about the goals and their ends being met through through a process. And it seems like this is the end game now. The end game was ultimately put into motion in Baal, and now the end game is control of Jerusalem and the ejection of Palestinians out of that land, and it's controlled for a Jewish state. Now, my view in this is that they wanted to set up a place where they were immune from control of anyone else. In other words, I'll give you an example. In America, someone from the Jewish faith who follows criminal Zionism commits a crime in the United States, there is no extradition treaty with Israel, and you'll find that criminal getting on a plane and running off to Israel quickly, never to be seen again in America.
That's what happens here. The six Jewish millionaires behind Harold Wilson. One committed suicide. There was the Gamex billionaire. Another one fled to Israel. It was a mafia. Hmm?
Well, and they've set up a mafia state to protect their interests and use it as a place to exert their power through their client states. Israel has client states. Everyone thinks that Israel is a client state of America. I believe it's the other way around.
Yes, it's not that Israel belongs to Britain and America, and that's why they're so anxious to protect it. It's that they belong to Israel.
That's right. And you see it through the insertion of their power into the political process. The House of Lords, the House of Commons, and all of the banking structure. What is the City of London if it's not a Zionist controlled one square mile of property?
Oh yes, and you know they think it was Pat Buchanan, wasn't it, who described the White House as Zionist occupied territory. Yes, it all begins with financial and corporate control, and then it moves on to the usurpation of political power, and that power is then diverted toward ends that are not in the national interest.
So we're seeing an end game here, because the goal has been, as my history has been reading, was to get control of that region, expand it from the Euphrates down to the Nile, and have a greater Israel, not necessarily called Greater Israel, but at least under their control, and that would include Lebanon, Syria, parts of Iraq, and all the way down through the Sinai into Egypt. Now, we see politically, and through their puppet states, they've already got this.
Yes, and Fuad Senora, the Prime Minister of Lebanon, is part of this. He had this 7-point peace plan for peace with Israel, like Fahd's peace plan, which again didn't work. In fact, these are all client regimes controlled from Washington and London, and therefore ultimately subservient to Zionism. I mean, look, Darrell, let me pose a rhetorical question.
Mm-hmm.
During the 3 weeks or 4 weeks that war with Hezbollah lasted, during which Israeli forces never got deeper than 16 miles inside Lebanese territory. During that time, when the Israelis were bombing, carpet bombing whole areas of Beirut, did you see a single anti-aircraft battery fire at an Israeli aircraft? Israeli ships were bombarding the Lebanese coastline, defenseless cities like Sidon, Tyre, and Beirut itself. Did you see any shore batteries fighting back? Nothing. So
no,
what was Senora doing? And Senora, we know, was for 45 years the financial buddy of Rafiq Hariri, who was the right-hand man of King Fahd, in spite of his humble origins, because he comes from a very poor Sunni family in the south of Lebanon.
Now, how in the world did Hariri run afoul of his masters? Because clearly he got his financing through the banking structure that he went to through the Jewish banking structure. Now, why is it that they decided to take him out? because it's very clear that he was not hit with a car bomb. He was he was rocketed and murdered to foment anger. And now, what did he do to run
the
ball?
Before that, he had got the boot, you know. This is the reason they hate Emir Lahoud so much, although Emir Lahoud is unanimously referred to by the Western press as a stooge of Syria. Emir Lahoud was, in fact, protecting Lebanese national interests, because this man had run up a huge public debt, which future generations will have to pay off. You know that here in Britain, we are still paying off the cost of the Napoleonic Wars. And just think of the immense public debt that was run up during the Reagan era in the United States. That will all have to be left for future generations to pay off. And they'll never be able to pay it off. So it will be an incubus round their necks forever. And this is how banking works. Because contrary to what popular opinion believes, the last thing a creditor wants is the reimbursement of his loan. What he wants is for you to continue in a state of permanent indebtedness.
Yeah. Now, here's what I see coming here. They've got control, of course, of the organs of information, the press, the film and music industries. In other words, there's not a single way we have except for this small internet programming and small radio programming that we do to get the word out. And so basically they're in control of this, James. What is it we're doing right or wrong here? Because I do see a serious backlash developing against Zionism in America.
I would think that when it comes, the tide of anti-Semitism in America will be greater than in Germany in 1933. Because you have to remember that America is a country that is composed in large part of nations with a tradition of anti-Semitism in their background. For instance, Ukrainians, Poles, Russians, Germans. Germans least of all, I mean, compared to Ukrainians or Poles. That is all lying under the surface. One day, the indignation of the ordinary American will just boil over, and they will pick on the nearest possible target.
Well, see, and what I'm hoping that is that we can avoid the innocent being... there are a lot of innocent Jews.
So, yes. No, I mean, I know one Jew, a Mancunian Jew, who fought with us in Bosnia. Admittedly, he was a convert to Islam. I mean, this is why I don't hold the genocide and all this nonsense about gassing and that. I mean, if you gas somebody like that, you're gassing your own friend. Therefore, I am not an ethnic anti-Semite. I oppose Zionism. Zionism
exactly.
Is a political creed. I want to make emphatic the distinction between Judaism and Zionism.
You're exactly right to do that, James.
Is a religion.
Yeah.
We respect that. In fact, of all religions in the world, it's probably typologically closer to Islam than any other. And therefore, as a Muslim, I cannot help but feel a certain kinship with people whose ritual practices are very similar to our own, for instance, their dietary laws. But Zionism is a political creed which aims at taking over not just Palestine, but Britain and indeed the whole world, and making it subservient to a corrupt clique.
And it's using its own membership, its own people as dupes, as lied to minions to go out and do its bidding as the elite managers of this criminality. In other words, many in the Jewish community who are acting on behalf of Zionism are doing it with a misguided belief that they're supporting the righteousness rather than criminality.
Yes, I mean, I think they're playing on the Jewish paranoia about persecution to secure their ends. We must remember, it says in the protocols, we shall have to sacrifice some of our own in this process. In other words, these people have no scruples about other Jews getting killed for their misdeeds. Absolutely none.
Yeah. Well, I fear for the future of our world, James, as you do, and more than anybody, you know, my associations that I've had with academics across the world, I've had probably a dozen or more top professors of this subject on the air with me, and in each instance, they voiced the same sentiments you've just voiced, that a pogrom against Judaism in itself would be a disaster unlike any other, But at the same time, when you see the way things are unfolding, is it avoidable?
Well, Zionism feeds on fear. A pogrom will only help Israel. We've just witnessed this war in Lebanon. Do you know that when the balloon goes up in Lebanon, where the Lebanese elite are to be found? Now, this man who's been getting, blown up so much by the British press and media, the son of Rafiq Hariri, do you know where he spent the 3.5 weeks of that war?
In Kuwait. In London.
Kuwait and London. And the Lebanese elite, whenever there's any sign of trouble, they take off for their villas in the south of France and in Switzerland. And this is something that the Lebanese elite and the Israeli elite have in common. The Israeli elite do the same. In other words, it's the poor who do the fighting for the rich. And the rich want Israel to exist so that they have a bolt hole in case there ever a reaction against them, the way there was in Europe in 1933, and they've somewhere to go.
Well, now we're taking a look at the division of the partitioning in a different sense of Iraq now. And there's a lot of false flag murder going on over there where there's car bombings, and many of them have the signature or the hallmark of the Mossad.
Look, I'm very glad you raised this point, because the British press, I don't know about the French press, I doubt if there'd be any more any less mendacious than ours, but they never sell the truth. Why? No one so far in the media in Britain has mentioned the fact that the Israelis are there in Abu Ghraib. And why are they there? Because they are with the world's experts in torture technology and extracting information from people. Now, this is what's going on, and it's part of a much larger picture. Now, this business about sectarian divisions. Now, it is perfectly true that the Sunnis have always been the ruling class, and they are a minority. In a small minority, I would say about 46% is against 54% of Shia in Iraq. But when Iraq was created, as I say, out of nothing, Nuri Said, the first prime minister of Iraq, installed by the British, he was a Turkish army officer who betrayed the Turks and came over to the British, so they made him prime minister. He said to the Shia, you look after the business and leave the politics to us. In other words, the only people with the political know-how in Iraq capable of running the country are the Sunnis. Now, the Shia have been made to feel ambitious to take over the state on the basis of one man, one vote, and the usual democratic myth. Now, what is happening is that the country has been divided along sectarian lines. Now, unlike India or Pakistan, where there are very deep sectarian divisions between Ahle Sunnah and the Shia, this has never been a feature of Iraqi life. But let us remember that key conference, just before the American invasion of Iraq, at which all the different opposition groups were brought together under a single umbrella in a hotel in the West End of London, that conference was hosted by an Iraqi who was working for the CIA. And this conference was organized along sectarian lines. That is the interesting thing.
Is this Chalabi you're talking about? Ahmed Chalabi?
No, it's before him. It was somebody else. But you're right about Chalabi and the CIA connection. Anyway, there was one man from Basra, which is, you know, a Shiite city, mm-hmm. and he was put down as a Shia. He said, I'm a communist. I represent the Communist Party of Iraq, which is being persecuted by Saddam. He said, I am an atheist. And you know what the organizer of the conference said? No, for the purpose of this conference, you're a Shiite. Now, that is to say, from the start, this sectarian civil war was planned as a way of being able to divide the country and thereby have an excuse to stay on and exploit its resources. And they have brought in the Saudis in this connection, because the Saudis, who are, of course, America's clients, they are going to poor Sudanese, offering them sums like £50,000, to be a suicide bomber. This is why we are never given the identity of anyone who, who's been post-mortemed after a car bomb, to go and blow yourself up. Now, £50,000 to a Sudanese, that's more than he's going to earn in 10 lifetimes or even in 15. With that, he can enrich his whole family. It's a decision that he takes. Sometimes he says no, other times he says yes. He becomes a suicide bomber and his family benefit. This whole thing is an artificial situation which has been created by the British and the Americans and the Israelis.
Yeah. And we've known that. We on the French Connection have known that for forever. We've tried to explain the nuance of it and do the kind of due diligence we're doing now by explaining the background of it. And I got to say that this recent alliance being formed between Turkey and Iran to attack the Kurds in the north, of course, is also pre-planned. I mean, Mosul is an oil-rich section under the hands of the Kurds. They don't want this. They want the Kurdish population to be subservient or eliminated, for that matter.
Yes, but the Middle East is extremely complex. You are right that the Allies did not fulfill their promise at the end of the First World War of giving the Kurds their independence. Hence, Kurdistan is itself partitioned amongst three states, Turkey, Iraq, Syria too, and of course Iran, so amongst four. But remember, America is very afraid of Turkey and does not want Turkey to get oil. So I don't think that the Americans will back a Turkish takeover of Mosul.
Well, what you're doing now, you're seeing the Iranians negotiating with Turkey to eliminate the Kurds in the north.
Yes.
Now, excuse me, is that going to actually take place, or is this just saber rattling between these two? They're not allies. Turkey and Iran are not.
Oh no, they're hostile. Even though you have a quasi-Islamic government in power now in Ankara, the real government of Turkey is the army.
Now, in Iran, you know, why was it the Iranians were behind the scenes buying technology from Israel, doing deals with the Americans in the 1980s and Ronald Reagan, and they were doing it through Jewish intermediaries and now we see, is there some false flag stuff happening between certain elements within Iran? I mean, now Ahmadinejad maybe is being genuine, but are there elements within his country that are on board with the Israelis?
Oh, there are. I would distinguish three phases in the history of the revolution in Iran. The first phase is the Khomeinist phase. And under Imam Khomeini, Iran, I would say, was a genuine Islamic state. After his death, it became a nation state with an Islamic face. Remember I said the ulama, they are the heirs of Safavid Shiism.
Mm-hmm.
And Safavid Shiism is essentially a political creed. To this degree, it resembles, for instance, Anglicanism in this country, which is more of a political institution than a religious one. Now, the third phase is the reaction of the Iranian people who are fed up with clerical abuse and corruption and who have put power into the hands of Ahmadinejad. And therefore, we see now Iran returning to its revolutionary roots. I think this is a very healthy phase.
But are they still doing backroom deals with the Israelis? And
I don't know. I have no information on this head. It's possible there are certain individuals who are doing so, but if so, they are running a great risk.
Because, you know, things look like they're going to go ahead with their attack on that country regardless of what the world wants. They will not drop the vitriol and the anger and the false anger, because it's not real. This is all puffed up for the cameras.
It's all bogus. They let India get the atom bomb. They allowed Pakistan to do so because it's an American client state. So why is Iran being subjected to all this pressure?
Well, now, is Musharraf under threat if he does not come out on the side of Iran in the event of an attack from Israel?
Oh, no. Look, somebody once put it to me very succinctly about Pakistani politics. This person said, you might sometimes find a Pakistani politician who is not controlled by the United States, but a Pakistani general, never.
Ah.
And this applies just as much to the person whom we call Maulvi Zia, that is, say, Zia al-Haq, whomever they regard as the pious general, the first one to say his prayers and all the rest of it. He was every bit as much controlled from Washington as is Musharraf. We don't call him Musharraf, you know, we call him Musharraf.
Yeah, well, Musharraf. Well, here's the interesting thing I'm seeing. Everyone with a brain or a military experience knew that sending 140,000 American troops into Iraq was not going to be sufficient. In fact, Shavnili, the general in the beginning, and many others said it would take closer to 300,000, and that was never allowed. So my point is, were they trying to neuter the American army by sending it there undermanned? Because it's being picked off and poisoned by uranium, and mm-hmm. and I'm looking at the complete destruction of any real American army right now. They're all going to return home sickened with poisons and completely destroyed like they did after Vietnam, and America's going to be really, at the end of this mess, defenseless.
That had not occurred to me. I had a simple explanation. It's true that the American government is surrounded with advisors and think tanks. But the question is, do they take their advice? I mean, they have advisors of the caliber of people like Bernard Lewis, who knows 50 times more about Middle Eastern history than I do. But do they take the advice of these people? So it may be that they underestimated the capacity of the Iraqis to resist. It may be that they'll have to do an ignominious scuttle like what they did in Somalia or in Vietnam.
Well, you know, James, we've been over a lot of subjects today, and basically what we've done here is placed on the plate of the listener here a great number of subjects that can be further explored. I know you've got some travel coming up. You've got some events to attend to. You are going to the Alhambra in Spain soon. I wanted to give you a chance to maybe share that experience that's coming up for you.
Oh, well, it's very much on the margin. In fact, totally unrelated to any political activity.
Yeah.
I was educated in Spain at two Spanish universities, Barcelona and Granada, and I've always maintained my contacts with Granada. So they've invited me back for a book launch. I'm not the sole author of the book. I'm just the part author. So it was a toss-up for them to go to Tehran to attend the Holocaust conference there, or to go to Spain. And since my prestige is involved, since it's the launch of my book, part of my book, I decided for Spain.
Well, I want you to enjoy it and be safe on your journey. We will invite you back. This is, you know, you are one of our resident authorities on Middle East history. And each time you come back, we plumb different subjects here. We've never been in talk about these particular issues before in such a way. And I'll tell you, this adds a great deal to the research that we've been doing.
Well, I am very grateful to you for giving me the opportunity to air my views, because they are so different from the official line that's being plotted in the universities. I just looked at the other day at the person representing SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies of London University, speaking on British television. It was as if they were a spokesman for the White House. So we have not just the Americanization of the Middle East through institutions like the AUB and the AUC, we also have the Americanization of Europe. In fact, I think that during the Second World War, the Americans used Britain as an Anglo-Saxon beachhead for which to conquer and subjugate Europe, and they have succeeded very well.
Well, we've got that. We can bring that subject up next time you visit, James.
Okay, there's a subject for a future discussion.
Yes, I would love to have you back anytime you're available. Ladies and gentlemen, James Dickey is a wonderful resource for this program. and a friend of mine, and I'm very proud to have had him on this station, on this broadcast today. And you will be invited back, James, but enjoy your trip to Spain, and I hope you visit a lot of good friends. And be safe, sir.
Okay. Well, hope to see you in the new year, then. As
thank
we
you,
say
sir.
In Arabic, Kul am antum bikhair. Happy
okay.
New Year.
And I will be talking to you soon.
Okay, then. Bye.
Thank
good
you.
Night,
thank
now.
You.
Good night.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, James Dickey, professor, student of history, researcher, a very kind man, honest always, and a very great resource for our program here. And I want to thank him again, and I want to thank you for tuning in today's broadcast. This is Daryl Bradford Smith saying thank you very much for being here today. Be well. Bye-bye now.